The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, a Lakota History by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 15, Possibilities. The seeds of change for the Lakota were deeply implanted early in the 18th century with the contentious journey of the La Vérendrye Party up the Missouri River. During the following decades, the Missouri became an important passage for commerce. Initial contacts between whites and natives along the river were friendly for the most part. But if there had been conflict and early resistance, our history would much be the same. The only consequence of early resistance would have been to impede the arrival of whites for only a few decades more. The die had been irrevocably cast because the members of a race that had inundated the lands and overwhelmed the native peoples east of the Mississippi River had laid eyes on this new and vast frontier. Obviously, they could not see the entire length and breadth of it, but they did not need to. Theirs was a far more inclusive glimpse. They saw possibilities. A different road. Wounded Knee was a devastating blow to the spirit of the Lakota people. There were no more significant armed clashes. If there were any further thoughts of resistance, they were spoken in cautious whispers. The U.S. military had demonstrated how far it was willing and able to go to subjugate the Lakota. Some second-guessing understandably occurred. Interspersed liberally in these conversations was the phrase "k'tat-ka," meaning essentially, "if only, hechumpi k'tat-ka." If only we had done it that way, it was part of the grieving process. No matter the clarity of hindsight, the harsh reality of life in 1891 could not be avoided. The self-confident stare of a people who had watched the La Vérendrye and the wagons on the Holy Road had turned blank. Now they gazed forlornly into the meager fires and empty pots. There was nothing to do but mourn the old days and face each day and survive it. That was the immediate and constant challenge. Survival now required the patience to endure inactivity. In the old days, the women could comment in passing that the food containers were nearly empty. In response, the men would take up their weapons to hunt. Now the women said nothing because it was the whims and policies of the U.S. government that filled the food containers or kept them empty. Hunting now amounted to standing in line on issue day for meager rations. Survival was dependent on adaptability. The ability to change and adapt was one reason the first groups of Lakota were able to survive and thrive on the plains. After Wounded Knee, it seemed there was little choice but to change, and in a hurry. But as a matter of fact, some change had already been happening. From the start of consistent trade with whites, items necessary for everyday family life were completely coveted, such as iron cooking pots, tin plates and cups, knives, wool blankets, needles, and trade cloth, to list a few. Over the decades, those types of items became part of Lakota households, and their pre-contact versions became obsolete. It was unusual, for example, for children born after 1850 to see anyone making an obsidian knife. After two generations, the knowledge for making stone knives still existed, but the skill and ability to do so began to diminish because no one made them consistently. The handing down of these kinds of skills did not just wither away unnoticed, however. It was a process of choice, not of coercion. By the early 1880s, most Lakota were making clothing out of cloth, especially calico or muslin, or were wearing white manufactured clothing. It was convenient but also necessary because the traditional raw materials, elk, deer, bison, and antelope hides, were no longer readily available. Cloth dresses and shirts were cut to traditional patterns, however, and for a time, both men and women's leggings were made from trade cloth or wool blankets. By 1890, that trend had diminished, and Euro-American clothing were worn more and more. Understandably, however, it is much easier to adopt the things of another culture. While our ancestors liked, wanted, and used clothing, tools, utensils, firearms, and oil lamps, they could not take on the ways of the whites as easily. While some cultural icons were easily discarded, such as stone arrowheads, the Lakota hung on to one of the strongest symbols of their culture and lifestyle, the tipistola, or pointed dwelling, the tipi, The people who had given in to the agencies in the late 1860s initially gave up their guns and horses, but not their dwellings. They did not have to, and they probably saved the Indian Bureau hundreds of thousands of dollars because it did not have to construct houses. Consequently, the teepee became an unavoidable necessity. The government had built a large frame house for Spotted Tail near the Rosebud Agency, but he preferred the open air and the amenities of the teepee. And Sitting Bull, who slept in a log house on the Standing Rock Reservation, also much preferred the teepee. The teepee enabled the Lakota to remain mobile, even in those last difficult months leading to Wounded Knee. If nothing else, they had shelter for the night, even if there was no meat in the kettle. Mobility also was very important. With teepees, they could run from trouble and easily take their shelter with them. By the 1880s, more and more teepees were made of canvas because buffalo hides simply were not available for repair or for new teepee coverings. Also on the scene were canvas wall tents acquired in trade. They were convenient to mobility as well. But in spite of their loyalty to the teepee, by the early 1800s, the Lakota were beginning to live in log cabins. In the middle of the decade, they had proliferated on all reservations. After Wounded Knee, however, defeated people gazed over the far horizons only to recall better times and old trails they could no longer follow. Now their longest treks were to the agency issue houses. There they had to follow the new rituals of survival. But physical survival was not the only issue. Now they had to learn to live like white people. So many changes so quickly, coerced or not, put the survival of the Lakota culture in question. Indeed, by the mid-1890s, entire Lakota communities were observing the American 4th of July holiday with their own celebrations and dances or in conjunction with the white communities. And in spite of the bitterness about their being involved in the death of Sitting Bull, Indian police were a strong presence on every reservation. Furthermore, Lakota men were enlisting in the U.S. Army. As a matter of fact, by the winter of 1890, the same year Sitting Bull was killed, a company of Lakota soldiers attached to the 16th Infantry was stationed at the Rosebud Agency. A further irony in that situation was that men whose culture had boasted some of the finest light cavalry in the world were now foot soldiers. This was a future Spotted Tail and Red Cloud had seen. A revelation had come to Spotted Tail inside a prison cell at Fort Leavenworth in the late 1850s. Red Cloud had traveled to Washington several times and was awed by the sheer numbers of white people. Both men were realists. The strength of the white man was obvious in numbers. There were more of them, and they had more weapons. Consequently, and probably reluctantly, each of them realized that sooner or later the Lakota would have to learn to live like whites. Washichuse, like the whites, was the phrase. Indian agents, other government officials, and missionaries who heard the translation of those words were quick to laud Spotted Tail and Red Cloud for their wisdom. They were not aware that both men meant precisely what they said. To both of them, living like whites did not mean becoming white. Both were afraid that living like white people would sooner or later take from the Lakota the essence of being Lakota, and forces were already at work to that end. By the mid-1880s, the reservation system in southern Dakota Territory, present-day South Dakota, was well established. White civilians were living on or near reservations, primarily at or near trading posts, military installations, and at Christian missions and parochial schools. Most of them were engaged in employment directly or indirectly connected to reservations on or the Indian Bureau. In short, the influence of white America had already come to the reservations, and it was not going away. Kill the Indian and save the man. Government and parochial schools were also in full swing. Those institutions were the most effective tools in the government's push for assimilation. All of them were more or less the reservation's version of the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. Carlisle's apparent success in providing a mainstream education to hundreds, if not thousands, of Native children was a shining example for all such institutions to follow. But Carlisle's success, of course, meant nothing less than confusion, humiliation, trauma, and heartache for the children who were touted as success stories. Most of them were not there of their own or their parents' free will, and most were separated from their families and homes for years. While a few Lakota leaders and parents realized that a formal education would be necessary for their children to be able to survive and function within the new order, they could not have foreseen the hardships their children would have to endure. The cemetery for students who died while at Carlisle is mute testimony that many children from several different tribes were casualties of the process. Lakota children were certainly taught the three R's, the same as Euro-American children. But before that could happen, they had to learn the English language, and that process began with an unyielding rule. The Lakota language was not to be spoken ever again. Long hair for boys was also forbidden. Usually on the first day of school, boys sat in the barber's chair for the first lesson about their new identity. Short hair. One former student recalls watching long braid after long braid tossed into a wooden box and having the sense that lives were being tossed away. Parochial and government boarding schools were doing their part in civilizing the Lakota. Christian denominations that did not or could not operate boarding schools nevertheless made great efforts to convert the Lakota to Christianity. This was simply a continuation of the colonious mindset. Missionaries had already been on the scene as much a part of the landscape as rivers and mountains. In some instances, they led the way for other whites, but now that the so-called Indian Wars were over and the Lakota were at the mercy of the U.S. government, the situation was ripe for missionaries. The missionary mindset, however, was not exclusive to missionaries. In 1879, Judge Elmer Dundy of Omaha ruled in favor of Standing Bear in Standing Bear v. Crook. The case was essentially about a group of Ponca Indians refusing relocation to Indian Territory. They had been duped into going there from what is now north-central Nebraska in the first place and walked back to their home territory under the most difficult of circumstances, enduring dreadful hardships. They were taken in by the Omahas and were living with them when the government caught up with them again. Standing Bear, the leader, asserted that he and his fellow Ponca were indeed trying to become civilized and were in the process of shedding their native identity. Therefore, they should not be forcibly removed to Indian Territory. Judge Dundy agreed on exactly that basis. One sentence from his 1,000-word opinion sums up the prevailing attitude of white America towards native peoples. Standing Bear's son had died in Oklahoma, and he and his wife wanted to reinter him in the earth of their ancestral homelands. Judge Dundy commented on that desire this way. Such instances of parental affection and such love of home and native land may be heathen in origin, but it seems to me they are not unlike Christian in principle. They were heathens, of course, in the eyes of Christians because they did not acknowledge or accept the Christian God. The indigenous peoples of North America had been labeled as such from the beginning of European contact, and the process of converting natives to Christianity had been a never-ending task. But it became a lot easier at this juncture on the northern plains because the target population was in the throes of traumatic upheaval and was never more ripe for the picking. The missionaries waded in. A hidden agenda. While boarding schools were turning the Lakota into productive citizens and missionaries were saving their souls, the government concerned itself with their lands. Its tools were not books or Bibles, however. The U.S. government had the Dawes Act. It knew that part of the key to eradicating native culture was to control their land. But that was a secondary objective. The Dawes Severalty Act, or General Allotment Act of 1887, was the final mechanism that secured the procurement of Lakota lands. Its passage was not general knowledge among the Lakota. Consequently, there was little awareness that it was being implemented. 36 years earlier, while negotiating safe passage through Lakota territory as one of the provisions of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, the U.S. government's peace commissioners had assured the Lakota and other tribes that the immigrants would need room only for the width of the wagon's wheels. 17 years after that, the 1868 treaty described the entire western half of the current state of South Dakota as a Great Sioux Reservation, where the various Lakota bands could make their homes. Attached to it was the unceded territory wherein the people could hunt. 7 years later, the commissioners were waiving the agreement of 1875, which sliced off the western third of the Great Sioux Reservation, including the Black Hills and its gold. By the time most of the Lakota realized that the trend was not in their favor, the United States had further divided the remaining tract into separate reservations. Everyone, except for those born on the agencies after the late 1860s, was painfully and angrily aware that something had been lost that probably could never be recovered. Space was not the only issue, however. The freedom to move as often and as far as they chose was limited by boundaries. The reality of the new and ever-diminishing boundaries was hardest on those who had lived the free-roaming nomadic lifestyle, especially those of the generation who could remember when a single buffalo herd covered the land from one horizon to the next. Yet within the exterior boundaries of the various reservations, the Lakota still managed to satisfy the ancient urge to move. Families would pack their belongings in the wagons. A few still use the ancient chungnipi, the horse carry also called the pony drag. The French called it travoy. Visiting relatives was as good a reason as any to pack up and move, or going to a feast or a funeral, or digging turnips. The blood of the nomad did not understand boundaries. But even as the Lakota were grudgingly becoming accustomed to artificial boundaries on their lands and in their lives, the Dawes Act was drawing boundaries within each reservation, which meant more limitations and new rules. Some of those new rules meant that the Lakota would not be the only kind of people on the land. The line was subdivided into 160 and 80-acre tracts and then allotted. The first allotments began around 1890 and were completed by 1910. There was, of course, surplus land. That surplus land was open for homesteading by whites. 42 years after the Fort Laramie Treaty promised that the Great Sioux Reservation and the unceded lands attached to it would belong to the Lakota in perpetuity, whites were claiming ownership by homesteading land within reservation borders. White homesteading of reservation lands is characterized differently by two separate viewpoints. It was a breach of promise, one among many as far as the Lakota and other Native tribes were concerned. On the other hand, it was deemed entirely necessary by the U.S. government, which hoped that civilization, that is, white society, would rub off on the Lakota. White homesteaders would act as role models by showing their Lakota neighbors the virtue of hard work and the proper way to use the land. Furthermore, the Lakota needed to learn that owning land in severalty was preferable to collective ownership. Differing philosophies about the land was a flashpoint in the so-called clash of cultures. Land is in the earth had always been a part of the Lakota identity as much as brown skin, long hair, language, customs, traditions, and values, and that identity was manifested in a lifestyle that allowed them to use the resources of the land, territory they controlled. Controlling a given area, however, was not the same as owning it. The Lakota, therefore, had not fought for ownership of land. They had fought for the freedom to live their lifestyle. But in the end, in the same way they had accepted geographic boundaries, they accepted the reality that they would own the land in the same way they owned their clothing and their dwellings. As for civilization rubbing off on the Lakota, that is still in question, depending on how civilization is defined. But one fact is difficult to ignore. White civilization did rub off thousands and thousands of acres of Lakota lands. The authors of the Dawes Act could not have conceived a better long-range plan to ensure that every acre of Indian land would one day be acquired, one way or another, by whites. White homesteading of surplus lands after allotment was only the first step. It is important to note that the Choctaw and Cherokee down in the Indian Territory of Oklahoma refused allotment and dared to take their case to federal court. The U.S. Congress promptly passed the Curtis Act, specifically aimed at them, dissolving their tribal governments and forcing allotment on them. The federal government was confident that the Lakota, the epitome of pre-reservation nomadic hunters of the plains, would turn to tilling the land, making appropriate use of it, as it were. That did not happen, of course. So Congress changed the rules again and passed legislation allowing whites to lease individually owned Lakota lands. Of course, the lease transaction was not conducted directly between the lessee, the white farmer, and the lessor, the Lakota land owner. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, as trustee for the United States of America, leased the land for the land owner. Many transactions occurred either without the knowledge or consent of the land owner. Even from the perspective of the current moment, it is difficult to decide whether white America wanted native lands more than they wanted to eradicate native cultures. At some point, however, came the realization that taking the land was the same as eradicating the cultures that had lived on it and with it. Nevertheless, Europeans and Euro-Americans had coveted the land from the beginning. Land was acquired by negotiation, which is another word for trickery, some natives say, by force or by legislation. However it was taken, the people who lost their lands also stood in danger of losing their cultures. The 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty not only established boundaries, but also inducements for the Lakota to adopt the Euro-American lifestyle. For example, under Article 4, the United States agreed, at its own expense, to build warehouses, agency buildings, a physician's residence, and buildings for carpenters, farmers, blacksmiths, millers, and engineers. A schoolhouse or a mission building would be built if enough children could be induced to attend school. Article 6 offered an individual allotment not to exceed 320 acres for any head of family who decided to be a farmer. Article 8 stated that if the agent saw that the head of the family really intended to farm, he would receive seeds and agriculture implements paid for by the government, of course, and possibly up to 3 years more. Furthermore, the government would teach him how to farm. Article 14 offered an outright reward of $500 for up to 10 people who grew the most valuable crops each year for 3 years running. Allotment took direct aim at Lakota identity as well. Once a man signed to accept his 160 acres, he was more or less forced to perform a strange ceremony. He was given a bow and one arrow and taken to a single bottom plow. He was then instructed to shoot the arrow into the distance, throw down the bow, and grab the handles of the plow. The symbolism of casting aside the bow for the plow was obvious. He was casting aside his old identity for a new one. The hunter-warrior was now to be a farmer. But there was more than symbolism to the Dawes Sovereignty Act. Theodore Roosevelt succinctly summed up the true sentiment of Congress when he said the act was a vast pulverizing engine to break up the tribal mass. Congress intended the transition of native lands from communal ownership to individual ownership to compel natives to become fully participating members of American society to the detriment of their own. That consequence was exactly what Congress had in mind. The needs of the community would become secondary to the needs of the individual. The authors of the Dawes Act assumed that natives were discontent with the condition of their lives and therefore would embrace any system or method enabling them to improve their lot. They could not understand that natives, by and large, were more discontent with the way the U.S. government and whites in general were treating them. That compelled them to band together tighter as families and communities, instead of bettering themselves individually. The tribal masses stayed together. Their land holdings were another story. It is difficult to deny that the Dawes Sovereignty, General Allotment, Homestead Act was created expressly as a mechanism to diminish native land holdings. Over the course of its life, the Dawes Act contributed to the loss of millions of acres. In 1902, Congress allowed natives to sell inherited lands, and in 1906, the Burke Act lifted restrictions and enabled individuals to sell their allotments. The Wheeler-Howard Act, or Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, generally reversed the Dawes Act and allowed tribes as well as individuals to own land, but the damage had been done. White ranchers, farmers, and speculators learned how to circumvent the system to obtain cheap land. The trusteeship status of the Bureau of Indian Affairs was to have safeguard of the interests of individual natives and tribes, but the complicity, if not outright corruption, of officials at the agency level made a mockery of the Bureau's role as an advocate. Furthermore, the Dawes Act continues to achieve its true purpose. In 1977, the Supreme Court of the United States reduced the exterior boundaries of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe of South Dakota. The tribe attempted to circumvent the state's move to redraw the boundaries in Rosebud Sioux Tribe versus Kenai, but it lost at every level of the federal court system. In the end, the Supreme Court agreed with the state's contention that 4 of the 5 counties within the original exterior borders were no longer part of the reservation. That position was based on the fact that non-Lakota people owned more land within those counties than the tribe or individual tribal members combined. The percentage was approximately 60% non-Indian ownership to 40% Indian. The loss of that land base began when the first white homesteader squatted on his 160 acres under the provisions of the Dawes Act and saw possibilities. And that concludes Chapter 15. Join us again for Chapter 16.
Kaya mako cheke trema kita cha pesho dakere mama kashka yero haya hiya aki chita o makia o haya.
This program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.